At Care Heating and Cooling, we put you first. You are the reason we're open 7 days a week and why it's easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Your safety is why we check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. And it's because of you that our techs are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. So it's no surprise that last year, Care was awarded a BBB Torch Award for ethics, because at Care, we're committed to doing business right. Call Care at 1-800-COOLING when you need a company you can trust.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 484.EZ4030, certificate number 30320, flying through the Gateway Arch.
Is this
like a Delta status level?
Yeah, that's right. When you get to 10 million miles, they let you fly any jet you want, through any aperture you want.
I choose DC-10.
It doesn't matter if the aperture is smaller than the plane. They're like, he's at 10 million. I don't know what you want. I got home the other night from my stressful guest hosting thing in LA, and I was just fried.
Your guest hosting thing?
I don't know if you've heard, John, I'm an interim guest host on the popular syndicated quiz show Jeopardy.
Interim and guest. That's two different little appendages.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what the difference is.
Yeah.
What's the difference between an interim?
Permanent guest host. Well, that's Joan Rivers.
Yeah, Joan Rivers, exactly. Johnny's guest tonight. I guess everybody's I'm a guest host who's working in the interim between Alex's passing and their being a host.
So when futurelings listen to this episode, will it be clearer to them what your status is?
Oh, I doubt it. Well, I mean, this will air in, I mean, the earliest people could possibly hear this. I mean, in the year 30,000 AD, for sure.
Right.
They'll be like,
for sure,
Ken was hated for his attempt at replacing the beloved Alex Trebek and was like burned in effigy in cities across America.
Or they might be kneeling at the foot of the golden calf of the Ken statue.
The earliest this goes in the time capsule is the very end of January. So yeah, I will have
the episodes will be airing.
Yeah, there will be a few weeks of me on TV, and I'm sure the internet
will have an opinion,
sneering.
Yeah.
But
we're recording this in a period where you are making these shows, but no one's seen them yet. It's including me. I haven't seen them, which I'm personally offended by.
I haven't seen them.
Oh, right. I guess that's right. You would be the first to see
them. They texted me and they said, hey, we've seen an edit. It looks good. And what that means is
you're not immediately fired.
Well, we never had to edit Alex. Like, he would do a 30-minute show in 30 minutes.
Right.
And there's really no editing. That is not true of my first week of shows. There's a lot of, hey, why don't you do this one more time?
Well, good. The staff of Jeopardy has been coasting for too long. Those people have just been living off the fat of the land. When I went to see the goat, I was astonished at how much everyone on set, which is 30 people, right? How many people are there?
More. I mean, less now in COVID, but...
But they are so... Their jobs are so chill. Everybody knows exactly what they're doing. People are just sort of walking around, chatting with each other. I was like, I'm stressed just being in the audience. Why are you people so happy?
It's funny because a lot of it was just, yeah, we'll do it the way it's always been done. No, my first day, nobody ever told me to get back in the makeup chair after lunch. Because Alex would just do that himself. Alex would mic himself, it turns out.
Now that's insane.
For the first time, they've had to send a sound person back because Alex mic'd himself for 37 years.
Well, sound people don't want you to mic yourself. That's incredible. I guess he grandfathered in.
He was good. That's the thing. He never wanted water at his lectern. That was a sign of weakness, apparently.
So, I agree.
So I had to ask the prop guy, the prop guy in Jeopardy exists to give the three contestants water and put up dividers between their lecterns so they can't cheat like Cliff Clavin on Final Jeopardy.
But this is it's a union job in Hollywood.
He's loving it.
He makes $120,000. Jeff,
he was the guy that handed me water in 2004. He's my favorite. He always called me Hacksaw for some reason. Hey, how's it going, Hacksaw? Yeah. I never asked him to call me Hacksaw. I never felt I was worthy of being called Hacksaw. But I wouldn't
describe you as a Hacksaw. Really.
Like if you saw my photo, you wouldn't be like, hey, I bet that guy's called Hacksaw.
Well, even knowing you as well as I do.
Maybe even less.
You don't have any Hacksaw qualities.
I had to be like, hey, Jeff, can I get a water? And he was like, oh, sorry. It's just Alex never.
So he threw you some shade a little bit.
Well, no, I think it was just like, here's why I didn't think of it. Because for decades, I tried to offer Alex a bottle of water and he would just.
Alex just glower. He did two shots of castor oil and like ate a little pouch of fingernails.
Diet Pepsi and a candy bar, I think. That was the Breakfast of Champions.
And there. Your diet Dr. Pepper. So it's really just a pivot.
And I haven't really been like trying to, like I haven't put that in my rider. So I've just been all Diet Coke all the time. Because I think
Coke is repulsive.
No, I love Diet Coke.
Oh, all right.
I'm not anti-Diet Coke.
The first thing I would have done if this was me, if they were transitioning to have me be the host of Jeopardy, I'm not saying it's not going to happen. They haven't reached out yet.
You're not saying when. You're saying if.
Right. But my rider would be the first thing I'd be adjusting. I would scratch the word diet off of everything.
And I'm not sure you would last in this job.
Giant bowl of M&Ms on the lectern.
Now, he's the ideal host, but he's a real handful about his dressing room, so... why was I saying this? Oh, right. Oh. So I had flown back, and my brain is just... It goes really fast. I mean, this would happen to me when I was playing. Like, I would play five Jeopardies in a day, and then that night, like, they would just kind of expand in my head, and I couldn't sleep. And that would happen hosting as well, because stuff just happens too fast for your brain to process.
Oh, so then after the shows, you lay in bed, and you're saying that there's a time compression that then is released, and you basically
relive
each episode in real time?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It's some... game show acid trip experience.
I can see that.
And it's not, and they're almost like kind of like, what do you call like compulsive thoughts you can't get rid of? Like, isn't there a term of art for?
Yeah, what is that?
Where you're just harried by, and I should be able to be like, you know what, Ken, let's stop thinking about Jeopardy and just relax and drop off to sleep. And I would still be like, oh, and then there was that whole category, and it wouldn't even be anything. Right. There was that whole category about construction, and then there was the stuff about,
I mean, I do that too, and I'm not on Jeopardy. I just lay in bed and think.
What kind of things are you reliving during the day?
So many things. Like,
I put that thing in the microwave, and it was too big for the carousel to turn, and I had to move it a little.
No, it's like 14 years ago, I was at an architectural supply store, and they had a bunch of doorknobs that I thought were dumb looking, but now I wish I'd bought them all. I mean, that kind of thing.
Regrets.
But
I've had a few.
That's right. But you, even when you would win a show, you would replay the show because of questions you got wrong.
And it's not trauma. It's not like, can you believe the dumb thing I said? It really is just more like...
Well, because you never lost.
Well, no.
Think
I said
about your opponents.
I said plenty of dumb things, but it wasn't that. It was just like the brain kind of having to sift through things it had not been able to do in real time.
Wow, insane. And that's true now that you're hosting.
I'm interim guest hosting, John.
Sorry.
I don't know about if the real host would be plagued by this. Probably not. I'm sure Alex has a glass of wine and it's gone. But for an interim guest host,
you're in a hotel room. My personal experience is after a big show, you go to the hotel room and you turn on Sex in the City, which is on every TV everywhere in America, and you just watch Sex in the City and
we get it. Your hotel at HBO, John.
And your brain just goes right out of your ear, right?
I wish. So I would just, I woke up in the middle of the night for like 2 hours just kind of with Jeopardy flashbacks.
Wait a minute. We're talking about Jeopardy again. Are we doing a podcast on flying through the St. Louis Arch?
And when I got home... I'm like lying in bed, like sleepy, but too wired from the, because I flew home the same night we did five shows.
So when you got home to Seattle.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
So like I get home to Seattle and I'm just trying to sleep and I'm looking at this, like some, I don't know, even some coffee table book from next to the bed, and it's got a poster
of this. You
have a coffee
table next to your bed? That's why we can't tax the rich.
I don't have a coffee table, just the books.
Oh.
Just the books. Someday I hope to be successful enough to have a coffee table to put them on. But it was some kind of old, maybe WPA looking poster. Well, it couldn't be because it would have been 60s of the St. Louis skyline. And there were planes going by overhead and they had the trail, the chemtrail, yep. As you know, of the plane.
Yep.
Spreading.
Chems.
Spreading whatever it spreads. What does it spread again?
Chems.
It spreads the chems.
Yeah. Although I recently learned, this has changed in recent weeks.
Oh, they've updated the recipe?
Well, no. Do not Google chems.
Hold on a second.
I used to refer to chemtrails as chems because that's the term of art within the chemtrails community. But hashtag chems, C-H-E-M-S, takes you to an entirely different culture, subculture, of NSFW.
Pharmaceutically enhanced NSFW activities.
Yes.
That you do not want to look at.
Even in the future, even if you are a sentient birch, I think you would still be, well, you would
they'd be more offended, probably.
The thing is,
a fine upstanding birch? They don't worry about poppers.
Having now been alerted, this is the thing about spoiler alerts, right? If you don't want to be scandalized, don't go. But if you thrill to the scandal, or if you don't even consider it scandalous, you'll just waltz happily into hashtag chems.
Yeah, if your plan was to have fewer people Google the word chems, I don't think you have succeeded by saying, whatever you do, don't Google chems, because it's full of explicit material.
I believe that futurelings are typically 14-year-olds, and that are always looking to expand their horizons.
You think future humans will be sentient teenagers? For the first time, teenagers will achieve intelligence and sentience?
That seems unlikely. I think it's going to be a Baby Yoda future where creatures are, futurelings are 50 years old, but still, you know, infantile.
Gulag the Baby Yoda?
Almost true now.
We're getting there. We're up to the mid-30s. I don't know if we've hit 50 yet.
Yay! We got to a millennium cut down joke, and it's only 10 minutes into the show. Let's get after boomers now.
That's too easy. So I'm reading this book with a picture of an airplane trail going through the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. And for a moment, I misunderstand. It's passing across it.
Oh, okay.
And for a moment, I misunderstand. This is not one of the 3D coffee table books that I'm sure you have.
Yes.
Your chemically assisted reading.
I have asked for a virtual reality headset for the upcoming holiday.
And the listeners, as they listen, you have it or not.
I don't. That's right. In the future, I have it or don't. And
you're Schrodinger's lawnmower man.
Every one of my family members has said, we don't think you should get a virtual reality headset because we don't trust that you won't disappear into a virtual reality.
I think my dad did kind of disappear when he got his.
Really?
Like, yeah. But luckily, he and my mom have been married for 50 years, and she was perfectly happy with that.
What else is there to talk about? But no, I think I will be denied it because there, it feels like a social intervention. Like, don't get John that thing. Because he'll just, it'll be like that movie with the U2 soundtrack, Until the End of the World, where you can watch your dreams.
Wait, you saw that movie?
Yeah.
I just watched the 5-hour cut of it, like a month or two ago.
There's a 5-hour cut of it?
Yeah, just Wim Wenders had to really cut it down.
I bet he did.
So the theatrical was only 3 hours.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have room for all the great Talking Heads and Nick Cave songs.
When that movie came out, I was going to the University of Washington, and the theater on the Ave.
Which one? The Varsity?
The Varsity.
Yeah.
I knew everybody, because I was in college, I knew everybody that worked at the Varsity.
Yeah.
And that movie was playing at the time. It was new, and nobody was going to see it. It was too esoteric. It was 3 hours long. It didn't catch fire.
We should have told people, hey, if you don't see it now, you're going to have to see the 5-hour one on
Blu-ray. That's right. There's not going to be the 3-hour cut. This is your chance. And I was dating a girl named Kate who was very, she was like one of my early super traumatic girlfriends.
STGs.
And she got out of class like a half hour before I did. And so every day during the run of that movie, she would get out of class and go to the varsity, go into the theater to Until the End of the World and wait for me. And then when I would get out of class, I would go to the varsity, and I was always a half hour late to the movie or 20 minutes late.
So you've seen it four times, but never the first half hour?
I've seen it 14 times. I mean, we met there every day. I don't know what we were doing. It's a completely, you know, it's such a head trip of a thing. Well, we go and make out.
Do I need to tell you what happens in the first half hour because you've never seen it?
I feel like I haven't seen it. What happens?
Well, they're crisscrossing the globe.
Oh.
It starts, you know, the beginning, before they get to Australia, they shot it in like 12 different
countries. I mean, I didn't see any of it. I was making out with my girlfriend, and we'd look up every once in a while and be like, whoa.
William Hurt's tripping.
Yeah, we're all tripping.
Because they did weird kind of video effects on the, it was kind of the beginning of that.
We don't usually anyway each other, but this is a really anyway laden episode.
I'm still trying to explain why I'm interested in the St. Louis Arch, and you won't even let me get to that. Here, let me anyway your anyway. Okay. Speaking of virtual reality and the University of Washington, when I was a student there I'm close to the same time, early 90s.
Early 90s, because I was a late bloomer.
Hold on. I was there in 93. And when didn't Until the End of the World come out right around?
I was there in 93. We were at the University of Washington at the same time.
But not in the same fraternity.
No. I wasn't in whatever Mensa group you were in.
I think neither of us were in a fraternity. I went to a Mormon student congregation there just off campus.
Oh, yeah. I know the place.
Yeah. There's a little building for religious education across.
Yeah, yeah. We used to do panty raids right there across 15th. in my biker gang fraternity.
There's a bunch of board games and, you know, you can hang out there on weekdays too. The bishop of my congregation, essentially the pastor of my congregation, was a guy on the UW science faculty. And I didn't know for the whole year I was there, even though I was taking CS classes, that he was like the pioneer of virtual reality, like for the Air Force. Oh. And he's like in the Encyclopedia Britannica entry on virtual reality, he is like mentioned as the godfather of it because he was like, you know, the first flight simulator guy. And what if we had a helmet and you could have binocular vision and
heads up displays?
Yeah. And he was like, he was running my student congregation and, you know, welcoming us every Sunday morning.
So you weren't taking classes from him. He was just your let's play Monopoly guy.
Yeah. And, you know, a little, you know, a homily on Sunday morning and, you know, let's stick around and have snacks after the service. And, and it turns out he's some Air Force virtual reality god, and I had no idea.
And you never figured it out in the time that you knew
I found
him.
It out towards the end of the year, and I asked him once about it. He was like preparing my paperwork to go on a Mormon mission. So like I met with him a couple times for him to fill out all the forms. I was in Spain by fall. And I said, so I just heard about your previous career and what you teach. And I was really interested in virtual reality because I don't know if you remember the other thing about the early 90s is there were all these terrible movies.
Yeah.
Lawnmower Man and Johnny Mnemonic. And
right.
Suddenly it was a thing. And I was like, so which of the movies is accurate? And he was just annoyed. He was like, none of the movies are accurate. You understand nothing about me or my work. It was like the Marshall McLuhan thing.
He's just working on targeting computers, though.
Yeah. He just wants to blow stuff up better. Right. Anyway. By way of saying I did not have a 3D coffee table book. So there was a line of chemtrail across the St. Louis Arch. And suddenly it occurred to me in my tired state, I was like, is this a picture of someone flying through the Gateway Arch? And no, both ends of the chemtrail are behind the both legs of the arch. But I started to wonder, has anybody ever flown through the Gateway Arch? Because what an attractive target, right?
Right. You were off to the races at this point.
I don't usually keep my phone by my bed, and I don't think I had. I think I had to walk downstairs and get my phone because I don't have good impulse control, so I keep the phone on a different part of my house.
But you and Mindy have been married a long time, so she wasn't bothered.
What does that mean? Oh, I see. I think she was still up. Like, it wasn't late. I was so wasted. I was, like, trying to go to sleep at, like, 10:30, and suddenly I'm, like, interested in, has anybody flown through the Gateway Arch? And I get my phone, and I spend the next a delightful hour to 90 minutes reading about the history of flying through the Gateway Arch and other things.
This is 100% why we started this show. Because we used to only have one another to talk about these things.
If we don't do the show, it's just wasted time. You wake up and you're like, I could have been reading Dostoevsky last night and I spent 90 minutes reading old articles from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Yeah.
But look, here we are producing something, adding to the sum of human knowledge.
What did your research turn up?
So the answer is yes. It's such an attractive target to the stereotypical masculine pilot mind.
Of course.
That just wants to see a hole and penetrate it.
Sure, go in. Go in and get that St. Louis hymen.
Yeah, when the arch was new, there was all this Spider-Man-like webbing between the legs because they didn't want anybody to do it.
Right.
No. So the arch was built in. An interesting thing about the arch, just to hop back in time, I always kind of thought of it as a Space Needle copycat.
Oh, but it predates it.
Well, the Space Needle opened in 62, famously for the fair. No, the fair was 62.
Okay.
Was the Space Needle up in 61? No. And the St. Louis Arch was like officially ceremonially inaugurated by Hubert Humphrey in 1968.
Oh, so the Space Needle is the
it's older. So it's bigger, and it's bigger than the needle. You know, the St. Louis Arch would neatly and lovingly cup all the way around the Space Needle, assuming it didn't have any kind of membranous tissue.
Boy, that's some fanfic I'd like to read.
It's a Japanese robot thing. But in fact, the plans for the St. Louis Arch go back to FDR.
It's a WPA thing. That's why I thought it was older because somehow I've connected it to the.
No, you're right. It's just that Seattle built ours in like a year. You know, so what's his name? The Pike Place Market guy draws it on a napkin and then
Steinbrück.
Yeah, Steinbrück draws it on a napkin or whatever, and then 2 years later, it's a life-sized thing, and Elvis is up there.
Right.
St. Louis, on the other hand, decided in the 30s it was time to revive its waterfront and did not quite get to the gleaming stainless steel arch until like 1968, the summer of love. You know, it literally took a generation, like a medieval cathedral.
I laugh a pained laugh because I've spent quite a bit of time on the St. Louis waterfront, and describing it as revitalized gives me like the ironic chest pains.
Well, it was warehouses and stuff in the 30s. I mean, whatever you think of it today, and you should tell us what you think of it and alienate. I have to be very careful now that I'm the interim guest, temporary substitute host of Jeopardy, not to alienate any different Jeopardy affiliates.
Right.
So I don't have a bad word to say about St. Louis, but you can be the truth teller here.
Well, no, I love St. Louis. I'm St. Louis super fan, but I mean the waterfront, well, all of St. Louis is.
But it's a national park, John.
Right. That's absolutely true.
As of 2018.
And you know Obama. Nothing revitalizes a place more than putting a national park right in the center of town.
Well, it's just like Seattle, right in the middle of town. There are all these grungy warehouses and stuff. Mm-hmm. They tore them down and put up a gleaming Amazon campus, which is now empty. And all the restaurants went under. It's perfect. All the cheap apartments are gone, and now there's empty cubicles and foosball tables.
The Space Needle website actually says to the future and beyond on it.
Do you think that predates the first Toy Story movie in 1990?
No, I don't think so.
When did the first Toy Story come out? 97?
I don't think that they invented that.
To the future and beyond.
Totally transformed. Wait, to take your visit to the next level and beyond.
Well, also to infinity and beyond is a joke.
Yeah,
because there's nothing after infinity, just as there's nothing after the future. So making to the future and beyond a straight slogan is a bad idea, I think.
You're blowing my mind.
I just lost our Seattle affiliate. So anyway, the city wanted to, you know, revive this kind of grungy part of St. Louis along the river. Let's see, was it an anniversary of something? The Louisiana Purchase was 1803. So I don't even think it was a Lewis and Clark style.
The 160th anniversary.
Because, it would have been like the 130th. I think it really was like, hey, Roosevelt's in office. There's a new deal. There's federal money for this stuff. Let's put in something nice here to commemorate.
Westward expansion.
This is the center of all the departures from the Louisiana Purchase era west. It should be on the banks of the mighty Mississippi. Where better? So they are successful in getting President Roosevelt in the mid-30s to name it America's first national historic site. Today there are, what, probably hundreds of NHSs?
This is the first one.
Very first one with that official designation.
The embarkation point.
And do you know the difference between a national historic site and a national historical park, which we also have?
A national historic site is one that has no binding in law and and will not keep someone from tearing it down and building on a skyscraper.
They're both administered by the National Park Service, but they've chosen the word historic for sites and historical for parks. And the official word on why is, and it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I see that.
The site is actually historic, but the park would not be historic. The creation of the park followed whatever made it historic.
Right.
So it's a historical park in that it contains historic things.
Aha.
A site can be historic. A park
can only
cannot.
Be historical.
So there's your pedantry from the Department of Interior.
That is the kind of clarification that I desire. So thank you.
They wanted, as early as the 30s, they wanted some kind of massive, a massive shaft is in the original wording. Some kind of masculine centerpiece to commemorate the brave, bold men who ventured west.
This show is really turning into a snicker fest.
But the funny thing is, it did not turn out to be a shaft. It turns out, as we have noted, to be a more female symbol, a gently curved arch.
Right.
It's one of our more vaginal monuments.
Yes.
I don't even know what would be in second place.
John,
rank all U.S. National Historic Sites in order of
vaginality. I mean, there are some natural formations in the in the southern Utah.
Rainbow Arch.
Right, that qualify.
And the pioneers probably wanted to blow them up. They were like, that hole is a little suggestive.
Sure. Well, they run their wagon trains through it and then blow it up. So no one else can. But so, what else? I mean, no, you're right. They're all spires.
So it turned out, it never occurred to me right now that these are the kind of gentle curves you don't usually see on one of these. I mean, the Statue of Liberty is a woman, but, you know, kind of a mannish one, and I don't mean that in a mean way.
I would say that dams, like hydroelectric dams.
They do have the curve.
They're very curvy, and they're very, well, I mean, and they dam up a channel.
They're like the IUDs of our national historic sites.
Yeah, or like a what else? Dental dam.
Yeah, it's a dental dam. In fact, that's how the Hoover Dam was created. Somebody saw a dental dam lying on a desk and thought, what if that was bigger and spanned the Colorado River?
We could make power out of that. Okay, all right, so dams.
So in 1945, the state holds a architectural contest. What will be this giant centerpiece of this kind of newly revived John Snickers part of town? Mm-hmm. And, there are thousands of entries, architects and artists and designers.
And 99% of them are aspire.
Are literally a phallus, uh-huh. Like some with veins.
Like the green office building downtown that now houses our all of our city offices.
Is that the worst of the?
Yeah, the one that like has a... Like a head on it,
right.
The one next to the Columbia Tower.
One thing you can say about the
Seattle Municipal Tower.
One thing you can say about this New York trend for these needle condos with very small footprints,
right,
is that they are not big girthy shafts.
No, they've it's kind true. Of,
they could not afford enough land to have the phallic symbol that every skyscraper builder craves. So now they have these little tiny pointy spiky spires, which are maybe a little more elegant. I don't know.
Yeah, they have taken away the the girth, but they have maintained the desire to
puncture the heavens.
Yeah, penetrate the sky and impregnate the clouds.
And that's where Dr. Strange lives. He lives in one of those, and some of them are pretty awful because they're too small for any kind of design choice.
Right.
So they're really just a shape, a
they're
long skin. It's just a stick pretzel.
Yeah.
What do you call the kind of pretzel that's not
a pocky?
Yeah, it's a big pocky with no frosting.
We don't know that. But they're all owned, I'm talking about the no frosting part. We don't know. I don't think anybody lives in those buildings, right? It's just Russian and Chinese billionaires that buy those.
It's just giant surveillance antennas disguised as skyscrapers.
Those buildings in all their elegance and all their rather height, which I guess
is that the same as elegance?
The modern equivalent of elegance is just like
we can't achieve elegance, height. But we can put the money we would have put into elegance into height.
But it does really show how the weak force of gravity really restrains us, because as tall as they are not that tall relative to as high as birds fly.
For example.
Or airplanes fly.
In this case, we're going to see some airplanes flying a little lower.
Right.
If we ever get away from Dr. Strange's penthouse.
I really want to see somebody fly a biplane through Manhattan as like a pylon course and just see if you can go from Harlem to the Battery at 500 feet. Like what, but not just go down Third Avenue. Like
you can't pick a canyon.
You have to just, like, somebody could trace a route that you could make the turns. Oh, that would be an exciting race.
500 feet. You're going to scare some people.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to scare some people in those open-top tourist buses.
Yeah. Well, oh, yeah. Oh, actually, these days, it's probably a bad idea to fly an airplane really low through Manhattan.
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything, because that kind of is going to be the end point of this entry with the history of flying airplanes at U.S. national monuments. That's gotten a little more complicated in the last 20 years.
I'd like to point out that in the middle of this episode, my daughter entered our bunker and brought me a fresh cup of coffee.
But super unhappily.
Because she doesn't like to do it. I don't know who encouraged her to do it, but...
Do you think it was an inner voice of conscience, or do you think someone told her to?
Every morning, I call her from my room and say, bring me a cup of coffee. And every morning
she says... This is why you had a child.
Every morning she says no. And then we engage in a negotiation, you know, often through my bedroom door. Please get me a cup of coffee. She says, no, you don't need a cup of coffee. Go back and forth. And about 65% of the time I convince her to bring me one. But how many times in all the years have you seen her come in here with a fresh cup of
coffee? First time. I didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah. I thought maybe she was going to, like, splash you with it. You could have. You didn't have to have a biological child. Some Wallace and Gromit contraption would have delivered you a hot cup of coffee to your bedroom.
I worked for years to build one, and I just couldn't get it.
And when it failed, yeah, we decided on sexual reproduction.
That's right.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
So our contest is held to design this new whatever it will be. And a Finnish-American architect named Eero Saarinen, right, and I'm sure the Finns are mad. I probably said it wrong.
Well, he's been Americanized because we talk about his architecture all the time.
He said it in a weird Midwestern twang, probably, and that's why I said it that way. He is not yet – I mean, he became one of the most famous architects of the 20th century. All his great modernist chairs and just beautiful modernist concourses at JFK and Dulles. I mean, that if you've ever seen the kind of the swooping roof of the Dulles Airport.
Oh, have I ever.
That's all Eero. That's my Eero. But at the time, he had done none of that yet. He had not designed a single weird round chair.
I mean, he may be your Eero, but he's an Eero to us all.
That's right.
American Eero.
He's the greatest American Eero. His dad, Eliel Saarinen, was one of the great architects. Eero was only 35 when his firm got the telegraph announcing that he was one of the finalists. Unfortunately, the secretary had missent the telegram to his more famous father, Eliel Saarinen, saying
who hadn't even designed one.
No, he actually had sent in an entry as well. So we've got some inner family drama here. And the secretary sends the telegram to the wrong Saarinen, and there's a bunch of celebration and cork popping at Saarinen and Sons, whatever his architectural firm is.
Well, except slinks off to his office.
But a few hours later, the situation is corrected, I think, with a phone call. And then his dad, it's a touching story, opens another bottle of champagne to celebrate an even more outstanding achievement. His young son.
Hey, there's no one more effusive than the Finns.
Is a finalist for this amazing. That's true. The famously effusive Finns. Wait, that's not true.
No, it's not at all.
Well, maybe he'd been Americanized.
Yes.
Or maybe it was just the first bottle of champagne in him. Saarinen's proposal is, spoilers, a giant stainless steel arch. At first it is
10,000 feet tall.
Yes. And then he did some math on the back of an envelope. It's at first the legs are square, the footprint is square. If I don't know if you can picture it today, but the legs of the Gateway Arts John are
triangular.
They are, yes, they are three-sided where they hit the ground. And I think even at the top it stays triangular. It's just it's much thinner at the top.
What do you call a shape that is a triangle at the bottom, but a smaller triangle at the top?
It seems like tapering, some kind of impossible triangle. Yeah, it tapers, and I guess it must. I need to look at a picture. Maybe it does flatten out at the top, because of course there's an observation deck at the top with windows.
Is it a Mobius strip?
No, it does have. It doesn't have. It has at least three sides. It is not one sided. Mathematically, it is not a parabola. It's called a catenary, or an inverted catenary.
What is the difference? A parabola.
A parabola is the shape a ball makes when you toss it in the air.
What if you toss
the acceleration of gravity downward,
straight up, and then it
comes. Matter what you do, no matter what angle you choose, it will make a parabola because of the squared acceleration of gravity pushing downward.
But you don't think I could throw a ball up and it would trace the St. Louis Arch?
You could not. It would trace a similar shape. A catenary is the shape that is formed when a chain is suspended by both ends and naturally conforms to the shape of its own weight.
Oh.
They're very similar.
Inverted.
Yes, and that upside down. Imagine gravity is now pointing up in St. Louis. Things are, Cardinals hats are flying off of people's heads.
That's been my experience.
What's the local cuisine there in St. Louis? They eat
Budweiser.
They eat Budweiser. Cans of Budweiser flying into space and knocking out Elon Musk satellites. If you held a chain the length of the St. Louis Arch at its base, it would mimic nearly the exact shape. I think it's Saarinen often claimed it was a plain catenary because arch-wise, that's the stablest shape. Because that's the shape that stuff wants to be, there's no shear force pushing the legs outward.
Right.
Like the legs hit the ground. The legs at every angle are making the exact angle that that they want to be. So the only force is downward compression. Nothing's pulling it apart, inward or outward. In fact, I think it's a slightly adjusted catenary. I think it's a little bit weighted. I think he finally decided it would be a little too pointy and McDonald's-like. Uh-huh. Although this predates the Golden Arches if it's the mid-40s. And so it's a little bit flatter and rounder.
And how long ago in math was the catenary discovered and described?
Oh, the ancients, I think. Because, you hang a chain or a string, that's the shape you get.
Right.
It was, they probably knew, I don't know if they knew the equation for it. I don't know. They knew the parabolas, obviously. Those are, I think they had the equation for the parabola. Somebody's going to tell me.
Yep, for sure.
There is some pushback. Some people don't like the arch for various reasons. It looks futuristic. The World War II is now over. The American century of prosperity and peace has begun. A gleaming, round, stainless steel, future-y thing seems the perfect symbol of this. And even if you read Humphrey's introduction in 68, it still sounds like a guy of that generation being like, out with the old, out with the shoddy, out with the refuse of yesterday. He uses the word shoddy,
Wow.
Like now we get well-made stainless steel stuff.
And it would have been impossible to make this in 1905.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Well, let's see. As soon as you have steel, the first steel girder skyscrapers kind of make the skeleton of it possible.
Right.
I don't know what other techniques you need to clad it.
But skyscrapers, you've got your girders.
You start at the bottom and go up.
You've got bridges by this point that have steel suspension, arches. Yeah. But is the catenary? Is there something intrinsic to the way it is, the stresses on the shape that would have required an especially modern technology?
Yeah, maybe, and especially because during the building of it, the arch is not yet stable because you're starting in two legs and building these precarious curves. And I think at every point they have some kind of a derrick thing, a horizontal derrick thing in between, kind of
keeping
each side from tipping over.
So there's a keystone that goes in at the top that holds.
Essentially,
yeah,
just like any arch, and that's what happened. At the very end, this thing got slotted in the top, and because this is all happening in the late 40s, you probably assume that keystone would have been dropped in very soon. No, it took again 20 years between his winning the contest and the construction.
Was the thing wasn't in construction or under construction for 20 years.
It was under construction for a surprisingly long time, like the bulk of the 60s.
Wow.
But there was the longer gap is like through the 50s when it's like, okay, now let's, you know, now we need the money for this. Now we need to, the railroad had to be moved. You know, there's all the infrastructure of just turning that part of town into a park before you even build the big thing. I read one of the most interesting pieces of pushback Saarinen gets is from a landscape architect named Gilmore Clark, who designed mostly New York stuff, the Bronx Zoo and something else really famous that I just blanked on.
I've been to the Bronx Zoo in the last few years.
It's, oh, sorry, I lied. The Central Park Zoo.
It's wonderful. I have not been to the Central Park Zoo.
I was there in the last year and a half, right before everything shut down, and it's a nice little zoo.
Do they let monkeys just run around?
They do not. Like, just run around the zoo? They let seals swim around. That's about it.
I read something about the Central Park Zoo that there was a kind of like little monkey that was, I don't know, that was domestic enough that they just sort of didn't have them in cages.
I think those days are gone.
Oh, well.
I have been to like some zoo in Amsterdam where there's an island of lemurs and you just go to the island of lemurs and the lemurs crawl all over you.
I've been to the island of lemurs in my dreams.
It's a horrifying Indiana Jones style experience.
Oh.
The 64 World's Fair. He designed the Unisphere and all the, you know, out in Queens, the...
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Tony Stark one. It is. So he's one of the leading American landscape architects, and he hates the arch. He says it is based on the kind of the monumentalist fascist architecture of Mussolini. And this creates two scandals.
Oh, that's a diss.
First of all, America is mad that they might be getting a fascist arch. And second of all, architects are all uppity because he's accused him of plagiarism. Like apparently if you're an architect getting compared to Mussolini, one of the worst things is one of the worst parts of the accusation is that you've plagiarized an Italian arch.
But a triumphal arch is like an arc de triomphe.
Sure, there's a long history.
It's right there in the name.
Those go back to antiquity, I think.
Yeah.
I think the Romans had triumphal arches to march their armies through.
But none of them are centenaries.
Catenaries.
None of them are catenaries.
Ooh, when will we get to the centenary of the catenary? 2068. That's something to look That's forward
a,
to.
A ways off.
Even construction takes a long time. There's a lot of, it's a Midwestern, it's a St. Louis massive construction project. There's unions.
Right.
The AFL-CIO doesn't want the black unions to have any part of it. And it's not because we're racist, you understand.
No, not at all.
It's just because they're the rival union and they've been, you know, they're not as upright as us. Maybe they were scabs.
Sure.
So there's a racial element, which is not great for this thing that's supposed to commemorate, you know, the history of Dred Scott and Missouri Compromise and all the civil rights angle of putting a big thing in downtown St. Louis.
But that puts a real St. Louis spin on it for there to be a contentious racial labor problem.
Union delays. And there's all kinds of discussions about, it was supposed to open in 64. Like that was even once construction started, and then it took 3 to 4 years longer.
Well, so that's why our foe is mad, because it's taking away some of the thunder of his landscape architecture of the 64 World's Fair.
Oh, that's probably true. Oh, by the way, this guy was a huge crank. Big sourpuss. Hates the Jefferson Memorial, hates the Pentagon, hates the Truman Balcony, which has been an entry in the omnibus.
How do you hate the Pentagon? I mean, I can understand how you hate the Pentagon, but like, Pentagon.
I like how the Jefferson Memorial to you is a little bit controversial.
I mean.
But how can you hate the Pentagon? What has ever gone wrong in that building?
The Jefferson Memorial is you know, pretty, it's pretty revisionist. Or I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know, it feeds into his whole Greek temple aesthetic.
Whereas, I think that's what he didn't like. It was a fake old-timey neoclassical.
But the Pentagon.
Come on.
It's just like, it's the largest office building in the world, Ken. We should do an omnibus on the Pentagon.
Has its own...
ecosystem.
Has its own subway and its own subway.
Yeah.
The train and the restaurant, both.
It makes its own weather.
It has a post office. It has a Swarovski. I don't know what it has.
Does it?
I doubt it has a Swarovski.
No.
It
makes its own wars.
it can affect the weather half a world away. For example, in Cambodia. There's all kinds of plans about what's going to be done with the river. At one point, Walt Disney wants to build Disney World there. There's a few years where it kind of looks like there's going to be a massive historical amusement park there. But finally, in 1967, the tram is completed up one of the legs. Before then, it was a 45-minute walk to the top. That's the same summer that the visitor center opens. The first people go to the top. And as I've said, Vice President Humphrey dedicates it the following year. Interestingly, the latest big change to the arch happened in 2001 when it was lit for the first time.
In 2001?
For decades, there was no agreement on how or if it should be lit. And I think maybe the problem was getting somebody to pay for it.
Whoa.
So it was, you know, St. Louis would brag about how it's lit only by our gleaming skyline. But really what that meant is we haven't been able to figure out, electricity.
Yeah. Now, how would you light it? I mean, you don't want it, you want it to be evenly lit.
Right.
But it's much easier to light the bottom part of it than it would be the top.
It sure is. To this day, I'm not sure, but it first was lit in November 2001, which may again be related to the events 2 months prior. I don't know. At the same time, over this 40-year history of getting this thing built, 30-year history, we'll call it, almost 40, another trend is going on, which is early in aviation, barnstorming pilots start to do dumb stuff.
Sure. That's their favorite thing.
Because at first, it's interesting just to see somebody fly a plane.
Yeah.
But you know how people are.
Pretty soon, you want to see them fly a plane through a barn.
Exactly. So I've seen a plane go up. What else you got?
Right.
And that's when people start testing the limits of what you can do with a plane. In 1911, a pilot named Lincoln Beachy, in front of an audience of 500,000 people, flies over Niagara Falls and then under the bridge there, under the international bridge between U.S. and Canada.
Right.
And that's very exciting. You've seen a plane in the sky, but what if, John, I were to tell you that it were between the earth and a bridge? Pretty good, right?
I'm more impressed.
In 1919, and really, it's kind of a shame this comes in the middle of the entry, because first of all, it means this is going to be a very long entry. But second of all, this is probably the best bit of arch penetrating that's ever been done. After World War II, of course, troops are marching through the Arc de Triomphe triumphantly. That's what it's for.
Right.
And airmen are asked to walk through the arch with...
holding a plane aloft.
With the military parade. And they are angry. They feel this demeans them to be on the ground. They should be doing some kind of flyover.
Hear, hear.
So the World War One pilots are drinking wherever they drink near an aerodrome, and they decide, you know what we're going to do?
You know, Snoopy is
right. Snoopy's there.
We'll take you right there.
Snoopy's quaffing a root beer with Bill Malden. That's a good reference. and these pilots get a little loaded, and they decide, you know what? Here's paybacks. What if we just fly through the Arc de Triomphe in one of our little biplanes?
Oh, that's payback. But you've been to the Arc de Triomphe. There's not a ton of room in there for an airplane.
It is not very big.
No.
It's the size of a city traffic circle.
Yeah, a triumphant arch. But it's, you know, it's, I don't know. There's not like...
Here are the measurements. How many feet across do you think the aperture in the Arc de Triomphe is?
40.
Very good. It's 48 feet wide. And these pilots are flying planes with like a 25 to 30 foot wingspan.
Right.
So you have somewhere between, let's see, in this case, it's a 27 foot, you have 10 feet on each side, basically. Mm-hmm. I've never flown a plane, but walk me through this. How is that a tricky?
Yes.
Like keeping a 10 foot?
Well, but also how tall is it? 100 foot high?
Yeah, it looks about 100 feet.
Yeah, so you've got to line up both dimensions, and then I mean you can thread it, but you've got to be going in a straight line. You hope there's not. Oh, the other thing would be that a thing like that, it's because it sits in an open plane, it's going to create little wind
cross
drafts
currents
and stuff, right? So you get right in the center of that arch, and then there's a sheer wind kind of waiting for you on the other side. I mean, I wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it.
As a
person, are you just deciding now?
As a person who has soloed in a 172 like five times, I don't feel like I'm the man to do it. But those biplane pilots, they could do amazing things.
They could. Like, would you turn sideways like the Millennium Falcon?
I would do that even less.
Is that not an option in a biplane? You can do that in a biplane,
right? I
think
it is.
But not at that altitude.
They could do it. I personally wouldn't want to be on the airplane.
The pilot that
actually, no, I would. That seems fun.
Do you want to be in the back seat?
I would be in the back seat.
It's like it's a mad world.
Yeah.
Your wife falls out and nobody notices. The pilot chosen for this is Jean Navarre, you know, the greatest French ace of the war. He begins practicing and almost immediately kills himself practicing.
Really?
He crashes his plane and dies trying to prepare for this. I mean, he's not practicing Apnar. He's not right. buzzing the Place de l'Etoile every day or whatever.
Right. He's just trying to do the stunt.
Yeah. He's just, you know, he's found a place where he can practice the stunt and he crashes his plane and dies.
This makes me want to do it less.
Well, it did not deter Charles Godefroy. Godefroy, maybe? Hmm. His, you know, the second best pilot they could find.
Who also died?
He spends 500 hours. He finds a bridge of about the right height and altitude. He spends about 500 hours buzzing this bridge.
500 hours?
Sorry, I'm lying. He has 500 hours total airtime during the war.
Oh, okay.
So that's a lot, right?
Yes. Is that a lot? Well, yeah, it's a lot.
That's a lot.
During the war, which was only 4 years long?
A few years.
Yeah, that's a lot of flight time.
Because those were short flights. They didn't have a lot of fuel, right?
Right.
Okay. I mean,
you often see jet jumbo jet pilots who have 2,000 hours throughout their entire career, including their time in the Air Force.
Don't fly Frontier. That's what I'm saying. What's the number where I should feel safe?
I mean, in a biplane, I would say 500 hours.
But he does do repeated practicing. You know, he spends weeks practicing at this bridge. He gets a journalist friend to film it. So we now have footage of this guy flying through the Arc de Triomphe. The authorities, of course, were extremely unhappy and, in fact, banned the footage. So it was impossible to see for many years. They wanted to control the idea of a guy flying a plane through the Arc de Triomphe.
Can you see the footage now?
Yeah, it's online.
Oh, wow.
Check it out.
I will.
So that's really the peak of arch flying because, again, 10 feet on each side.
I'm now picturing you late at night having come home from Jeopardy watching him fly through the Arc de Triomphe. In the middle of the night on your iPad.
That's exactly what happened. This continues in 1942. That's the same year that someone first, I believe, flies under the Golden Gate Bridge and the Sydney Harbor Bridge. Two bored Americans did it in Kitty Hawks. And the following week, five Dutch pilots were like, we should do it in formation. Because, you know, they're trapped in Australia. The war's broken out.
Right.
Please see our episode on the, what was it called? Operation Endless Sunrise. Yeah. Order of the Double Sunrise, or something like
that's
that.
Right.
So these Dutch guys are stuck in Australia. They decide they're going to fly five planes in formation under the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
2 days later, seven Lords of Leaping went under the bridge.
Five planes a bridging. They get the thumbs up from this radio operator named Joe Mueller, and they take off, and they all fly under the bridge. And they get back and they find that all hell is broken loose because I guess thumbs up just meant looking good, you guys. It did not mean he had actually asked the tower. They thought he had sought permission for this.
Oh.
And it turned out they had done it without permission.
Oh.
And it was a huge thing. And everybody
did they all
got
get demoted?
Yelled at.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. What's the worst thing that can happen to you in the Dutch Air Force?
Oh, the Dutch Air Force. I'm trying to even think of an image of the Dutch Air Force.
You get whacked around with a wooden shoe or something.
That's not true. I saw the Dutch Air Force in action one time.
Against whom? The Belgians?
No, it was during the Kosovo War, and I was out. I'm not even going to say what I was doing in the middle of the Netherlands.
I'm walking across some continent.
No, I wasn't doing anything like that.
Not going to mention which one.
I'm getting too teased by the futurelings for mentioning my past adventures, and so I'm not even going to say it anymore.
They admire you for doing it.
Yeah, I'm going to deny them
it's
a
just
bingo
all the talking about it.
Bingo card. But the Dutch Air Force flew over me at one point out in the middle of nowhere, and I thought, what are they doing? And then I realized, oh, it was like a Kosovo support as part of NATO. They were training to go support this, whatever, our intervention down there.
And they were looking good from your point
good.
Of view in a haystack.
I was like,
it's hot. What do you think about the shirts this month, John, that we have available on omnibusproject.com/store, thanks to our friends at Mediocrity?
I love the fact that we are doing shirts every month. I think our shirt designs are really incredible. I kind of want to solicit shirt designs from the more artistically inclined futurelings. The shirt designs that we are making are, I mean, I would be proud to wear them to a wedding or a funeral.
Would you wear this black Nagel pastiche of you and I?
That Nagel thing is so cool. I would wear that to the presidential inauguration if I'd been invited.
My hair is dark in it because Nagel never drew blondes.
Oh, right.
And I really, I don't know what is the effect? I look like the Kid Catcher or something from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Just a fantastic
great
shirt.
Great reference.
All the 80s, the font and the little Miami Vice stripes in the corner, it turned out great.
Yeah. Yeah, I think everything should be Nagelized, including the King James Bible, and we can start with Omnibus being completely Nagelized.
You want it to be? You think it should be literary works should be Nagelized?
Yes, I think that the story should be told in Nagel posters from hair salons.
I think it should still be written text, but it should just be with a much more Nagel sensibility. Like, and Jacob went up to Rebecca, who had pale skin and was scowling and pouting a little bit.
Lots of eyeshadow. Or it could be an illuminated manuscript instead, but instead of, you know, very florid first letters, it could be, you know, like one of the members of Duran Duran.
The other shirt is modeled on generic food of the 70s. This is funny. At the bottom, it's, you know, it says Omnibus Podcast, but it's like a generic podcast shirt.
And it has a barcode.
It has a barcode, which some people have found out what the barcode is a barcode to, and I thought that was a funny little Easter egg. I encourage you
to... Well, we won't tell what
it
is.
I'll leave that as an exercise to the listener.
Good.
It says serving size 29 to 90 minutes twice per week.
Oh, that's it.
That means we used to record 29-minute shows.
We have never done a 29-minute show. Is that possible? What could be the shortest show?
It must have been very early.
Yeah. We certainly don't do that anymore.
It's probably Starlings or Defenestration. 90 minutes also would be a bit much.
Too much. We try not to do that, but we do get close.
Yeah, so really, this packaging is making no promises about what you might get inside, but it's a fantastic-looking shirt.
Yeah, avail yourselves of these t-shirts. They are things that we're having fun making, and they help us make the show by buying them and supporting them. There are a lot of ways you can support the show, our Patreon account, and buying our merch, all help us a great deal.
The rotating shirts are from our friends at Mediocrity. We also have kind of all-purpose Omnibus and Futurelings hats and mugs and hoodies and whatnot. You can see all of the above by checking out omnibusproject.com/store.
I'm sure the Futurelings are, if they're not already, planning actual meet space meetups as soon as the pandemic is over. And having one of these t-shirts will let you be readily identifiable at the trivia night at your local pub where you and other Futurelings congregate.
In 1955, Seattle is actually the site of one of the most famous stupid plane tricks of all time. Huh? Seafair 1955.
This was site of many stupid events.
Site of many unwanted pregnancies, I'm sure. But before your term in office as Seafair God. Right. So you're not responsible for this.
King Neptune.
But a test pilot who was supposed to do a flyover in the new 707 from Boeing decided to barrel roll it.
Oh, he sure did.
Because he had done this. He had done it once before and realized, actually, the G-force is exactly the same. The aircraft appears to be fine.
Tex Johnston.
That's the guy.
A famous Seattleite and American.
And when he landed, he got yelled at by Bill Allen personally.
Yes, but then he realized he said, right?
Go ahead. I think somebody from Bell came up to Allen and said, "What are you talking about? He just sold your plane," you know, like, and that's true. I'm sure they got hundreds of orders off of this bozo barrel rolling a 707.
My folks were at that seafair.
No.
And saw it happen. Yeah.
Your mom must have been so proud when you were King Neptune. It was like if, you know, she'd been going there her whole life.
Well, that's the thing. My dad had already passed away, but when they asked me to be King Neptune, that was my mom's only quote was she said, "Your dad would be so proud. He loved Seafair, and he would that's your crowning achievement.
He would have given you a real Christmas present instead of those imaginary ones." So the FAA, not staffed with dummies, realizes that the St. Louis Arch is just a super tempting target.
Oh, before it even happens, they're like, this is going to be a problem.
Before it's even constructed. In June 16th of 1965, 3 years before the arch is dedicated, the FAA puts out a statement saying, any pilot who dares to penetrate our nation's most welcoming opening will be heavily fined and have their license revoked.
Oh.
And in fact, they put strict rules. I mean, it's a national monument, so it's the same kind of rules you would have around the Washington Monument or the Statue of Liberty. You can't come within 2,000 feet of it.
Right.
Any kind of erratic flying is going to get you in trouble. Nothing fancy around the St. Louis Riverfront anymore.
What's funny is that the arch has this kind of park at its base that is shaped in such a way as to evoke like a trench in a Death Star or whatever. It's like a very inviting, if you come across the river, It basically looks like...
Even the terrain welcomes you.
It does. It just says, like, come through me. I mean, that's the point of it.
That's what an arch means. Pass through me, wagon trains and trappers and Lewis's and Clark's.
Yes. Huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
Give me your Lewis's, your Clark's. And it's much wider. So it's... originally, the arch was supposed to be, I believe, taller than it was wide. It is now a perfect square. It's 630 feet leg to leg and 630 feet to the top.
This is like your moon illusion entry.
I know. It seems taller.
Looking at it, I cannot believe that it is as wide as it is.
It can be inscribed in a square.
Wow.
And so, and the legs are 54 feet wide. So you really only have, what is that, 520 feet of space? But still, that's... almost over 10 times the clearance of the Arc de Triomphe. So you don't even have to be like a flying ace to make it through. You know, it's going to be attractive to just weekend pilots who have had a beer or two, right? And the FAA is not wrong. Just almost exactly 1 year to the day after they announced their whatever you do, do not fly through the Gateway Arch. It's a hot summer day.
I mean, a 747 is 224 feet wide.
So you could get two 747s, wingtip to wingtip, Blue Angel style, through the St. Louis Arch. And that, I believe, has never happened. Someone would notice.
Yeah, that'd be on the internet.
But imagine you're in a small plane. Imagine you're in a twin-engine Aero Commander, for example, because that's what approaches the Arch on June 12, 1966. It comes in at a height of about 250 feet. So closer to the ground than to the top of the arch. Cause you know, it's widest at the bottom. Mm-hmm. You want to take it in low, I assume. Would you feel confident doing it to the St. Louis Arch in a plane?
Much more confident.
It's cause it's so much wider.
I think while you were in the air, as you passed through it, you would feel like it was narrower than it seemed. It's one of the things about being in an airplane. My dad always told the story about flying around, Mount Denali. Mm-hmm. In Alaska, and at one point he was flying with a bush pilot that he knew, and he said, you know, we're getting a little close to the mountain. Like, when are you going to pull up? And the guy said to him, like, you know, we're 4 miles away from the mountain, David.
There's a tour group there that has their hats knocked off and they're shocked. People try to take a picture, but nobody quite gets a picture in time. There are construction workers inside the arch working on it who report that it's to them a deafening noise and that the arch is literally shaking.
Whoa.
As the plane goes through. The 15 or so eyewitnesses say it's a blue and white or green and white Aero Commander. I don't know this plane, but maybe you can imagine it better than me.
Yeah, it's not. It would not be. It's like a two engine plane.
It's, yes.
It's a bigger plane than,
yeah,
than just a little putt-putt.
Yes. Although that part is disputed as well, as we'll see, because the eyewitnesses can only get two numbers off the tail registration, but that's enough for the FAA to narrow this down to 11 different Aero Commanders with that coloration and number pattern. And they tracked down the pilot of every single one. All were far from St. Louis, one as far as South Africa. All 11 planes have a perfect alibi and the trail goes cold.
No kidding.
Until 2016, on the 50th anniversary of the flyby, the 50th anniversary makes the news in St. Louis, and Donna Doris of Madison, Illinois comes clean. She says that day, my dad, railroad worker Earl Bolin, or he worked at the rail yard, I think, not a train guy, came home and said to his wife, well, I guess I got away with it. And she said, what do you mean? He said, watch the news tonight. He had flown his plane through the, according to Donna, her dad had confessed to flying his plane through the St. Louis Arch and then immediately leaving town at high speed, crossing the river, landing in Granite City, Illinois, and walking away before anybody could notice what had happened.
And did he have an Aero Commander?
He did not. So that's what's interesting. In fact, he never had a twin engine plane, on which all the eyewitnesses agree. Donna, when interviewed by the St. Louis paper, said that her dad at various times had a Cessna, a Piper, and a Piper Cub. And none of those you'd think would be mistaken for an Aero Commander.
Well, there are Pipers that might.
She said he never had a twin engine plane.
Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he had a twin engine Piper and she misremembered.
Well, it seems like that would be a thing you would remember. But there are, I mean, the thing about an Aero Commander is it looks more like a Piper than a Cessna.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and who is being asked here? You know, yeah, right. A bunch of tourists who saw it whiz by their heads. So.
They can't get the numbers off the tail, but they're like, that's an Aero Commander. A very unusual aircraft.
Over the following, let's call it 15 years, another almost dozen planes do the same thing.
Mm.
December 12, 1969. The following week, December 17, 69. April 16, 1971. And there's another unconfirmed one that same week. October of 71, early November 77, late January 81, early February 81.
So it seems like they come in clusters where somebody does it, and then there's another guy who's like, wait a minute, I could do that.
And I wonder if it's reported on locally, because the National Park Service tries to keep a lid on this kind of thing.
Do all these pilots get caught and have their licenses revoked?
Not a single one is ever caught. after the third one, the FAA institutes a $500 reward for any information leading to the arrest of any pilot who has flown through the St. Louis Arch, and they don't get a single one. That's all of them got away clean.
Incredible.
There are two cases where a pilot does not get away. In 1973, the first aircraft does it with permission, and it's a hot air balloon.
No kidding.
St. Louis tries to... Do you remember the 70s as a time of great hot air balloon fascination?
I do too,
but is that just because I was a kid?
No, it is because it was a super fad, and in Alaska, it was a huge part of Anchorage culture all up until the mid-80s. Like my high school football field...
Your high school mascot was a hot air balloon.
It was a
hot air balloon. Go balloonies!
My high school football field was a launching place for hot air balloons, and there were sometimes 20 or 30 hot air balloons in the air at the same time. There were jamborees. A hot air balloon landed in the lake next to my house.
Probably not on purpose.
Dropped down, touched the basket in the water, and then dropped all its ballast, hit the gas. They're super loud when they're on fire. And then pulled up out of the lake, and I mean, you hear that sound over your house, and we were just like, what is happening? All ran outside, watched this thing, just drip into the lake.
Boop, boop, boop.
Seemed very risky considering you can't steer them.
Yeah, I wonder if the pilot meant to do that.
But how could you steer it through the arch? I don't see how you could.
It didn't go well. So so I'm remembering the same thing you are, which is that America was just you could not watch PBS for 5 minutes without seeing a montage of hot air balloons doing something.
They were all over. And when was the last time you saw one?
No, they what happened to them all?
Well, there was some...
They once blackened the planes.
I looked this up, and in Anchorage, there was some new regulations, some insurance thing that basically just made it, just put the kibosh on the whole sport. It seemed like a rich man's sport. I feel like the Front Range there in Salt Lake City was a big hot air balloon.
See hang gliders there, but I don't know if I've ever seen a hot air balloon. I remember, you know, after seeing them on 3-2-1 Contact my whole childhood, I finally saw some hot air balloons launching over Woodinville out on the east side. Because that's they do that to this day. It must be good empty space.
You have to be somewhere
farmland.
Where you're not going to hit anything.
Yeah,
and you can fly for a while and basically like. Let the air out before you go into the mountains.
But I remember seeing them rising from, you know, rising above from Magnuson Park, kind of rising above the lake and the hills, and just thinking like I had seen Bigfoot, you know, because I had actually seen a hot air balloon in the wild. Recently, they've been putting one next to Green Lake and inflating it,
but not
taking it off,
flying it.
So you, from our house, you can hear the.
Yeah,
but you know, it's just a big lit. It's part of their lantern thing. Just this summer when Mindy and I were in Jackson, Wyoming, I was like, hey, this is it. Maybe we should, is this our time to do hot air ballooning? You know, it seems pretty COVID safe. It's you and one other person outdoors in a mask. And she looked it up and like there had just been a fatality.
Oh no.
in Jackson Hole, like the month before.
And that was enough.
And she was like, yeah. So I think that is something that does go to your point about how people started to realize it wasn't just a safe thing that anybody could hang out a shingle and launch hot air balloons. But in this case, in 1973, the city of St. Louis wanted to have a big balloon tradition, you know, like other cities. They wanted to have a festival and a great balloon race. And I think this has continued maybe to this day. But this inaugural one in 1973 started with Nikki Kaplan, a hot air balloonist, and in fact, I believe America's premier female hot air balloonist, launching through the St. Louis Arch, the first aircraft that had ever had permission to do so. She actually bumped into it on the way up. But in a hot air balloon, it doesn't matter that much.
You bounce off.
You bounce off. And that went great. The other time that the FAA was not left just shaking their fists in the air was when a helicopter did it on April 6th, 1984.
That seems much more doable.
Yes. And that guy got caught and arrested. And I think, we're, you know, it's beginning to be the era of greater surveillance, you know, news teams and surveillance cameras and today's cell phones. And I believe that helicopter in 1984 might have been the last time that the St. Louis Arch was aerially penetrated. Its virginity has been restored.
Is that right? In all that time, now it's just
nobody's done it in 35 years.
It's a dead deal. I wonder if this episode of the Omnibus.
Do you think we can bring it back?
I wonder if we've got, you know, it's the type of thing where if your pilot's license is about to be revoked anyway for some other reason, like drunkenness or a heart condition, why not go out with a bang?
Well, like listeners should not do it in our era, I think. But okay. if the year has five digits, let's say, and it's a Planet of the Apes world where part of the St. Louis Arch is still emerging from the ground, whether it's, you know, you got the top of it, so you got less clearance, or maybe just two legs sticking straight up. Mm-hmm. Why not use some of your precious fuel? Fly through that thing. Nobody's done it in millennia.
What if you're a futureling that has the gift of flight?
Sure. Maybe people are just zipping and diving through the St. Louis Arch in the future as we speak.
Yeah, I can see it. I can see the St. Louis Arch surrounded by fairies.
It would be pleasant to think so.
And that concludes Flying Through the St. Louis Arch.
I think that's our first verb phrase ever to title an episode.
Entry 484.EZ4030, certificate number 30320. In the Omnibus.
You know what? I'm going to say it's a gerund, actually.
It's a gerund.
It's a gerund. It wasn't a verb. Don't worry about it.
Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I'm also on Instagram, where you can see all of my swimsuit photos. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Please avail yourselves of the Futurelings groups on Reddit and Facebook and Stitcher and
Did you say Reddit? Did you say Discord?
Reddit, Discord. What's the Parler?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lively subgroup on Parler.
All of them. You can mail us real mail at P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155. Address it to the Omnibus Project, even if it is specific to Ken or to me.
You're getting mail bounced. If you, it just says John Roderick.
Yeah, if you are mailing things to Ken, like headshots that you want him to autograph and send back, please don't do that. If you want to email us, you know, or I'm sorry, if you want to mail us things specifically to one or the other, you can do so, of course.
So the reason why your mail is bouncing and mine is not is that it's my post office box you're drafting off of.
Yeah, that's right.
You realize you could get your own post office box.
Well, yeah, that's been true for 25 years. I could have had my own post office box this whole time, but I used to draft off of Sean Nelson's back in the rock days.
It would just come to his box and he'd be like, John, here's some mail.
Yeah, he'd be so mad every time, just like you're beginning to be.
I found somebody online who wants to, I was going to put this in an addenda show, but why not say it now? He wants to send us Gros Michel bananas.
Oh.
It's the person who, we recorded a show about B. Traven, like the same week he wanted that as a wedding gift.
Oh.
And I said, sure, we'll do that for you. Cause we had like just recorded it.
Uh-huh.
and he wants to mail us bananas, but they can't go to the P.O. box. So he wants a brick and mortar address.
Right. Now, what we need to do is buy a house.
Just to receive bananas.
Yeah.
I'm just going to use your house. It's not occupied right now.
Hey.
I'm going to use your, it's just a ravine right now.
Yeah, but a year from now, he's going to be sitting outside my house with binoculars.
You think this is the long con? He's pretending to give you bananas just because he wants to break in?
Well, that's the thing. He sends you one thing of bananas and then... And he feels like he can come ring your doorbell.
Maybe the crate of bananas has inside it some kind of little boop, 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 boop thing that laser that disables your security system, and a little robot comes out and opens the pet door for him.
A guy was working on my furnace yesterday, and I said, what do you think about these internet-activated thermostats? And he was like, don't put one of those in your house. Are you crazy?
Well, what's his beef?
Well, he thinks that the Russians can turn my heat on.
Oh, right.
So I don't. Who knows? If you're going to ask a question about the furnace guy, from the furnace guy about your furnace,
he thinks Jeffrey Epstein is turning on your furnace.
That's
right.
Right.
Speaking of the mailbox, here's a fun postcard. This seems like it's more relevant to you, John. Oh, even though he says Ken, you're my hero, but he wants to tell you that his dad proposed to his mom at the Captain Cook.
Oh,
is that an Alaska thing?
It's the, well, traditionally the nicest hotel in Anchorage. It's where where we had my father's memorial service.
Ah.
It's where I met Sarah Palin.
All the great events in your life. We ate at Gwenny's on Spenard.
That's out in Spenard. It's Spenard, on its way to the airport.
All so the time.
Gwenny's is one of those restaurants that has like a quirky interior. It's quirky. Very Alaskan.
Well, Megan enjoys your Alaska nostalgia. She also addressed this United States Planet Earth Milky Way, and it got here. So
well done.
That probably helped.
Nice.
And then Marin or Marin is a librarian who was going through some donated books because people just give all their junk to the library, and then the poor library has to throw it away. She found a copy of a book by the author George Sand and thought, I've just seen a trivia question about her. That's funny. What do they call that again when you hear about something and then you immediately... She couldn't remember the name of it. And then the very next book she opened in the box was this.
No, the Bader-Meinhof Syndrome.
A secret romance called The Bader-Meinhof Affair. And it literally has Fabio on the cover.
That is basically the story of my song Cinnamon, The Bader-Meinhof Affair.
Did you read this book, this romance book with Fabio on the cover, and decide this should be a pop song?
I didn't. It's an example of the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon. When was that book written?
It seems quite recent.
Fabio.
The funny thing is that's Fabio, but it has kind of an old Fabio wearing like kind of a weird coat where you can't tell he's got a gut now.
Yeah.
But I guess they still think that Fabio on the cover
sells a book.
2002.
Oh, so that is right about when I was writing the song Cinnamon. But it's before the song Cinnamon was released to the general public. So it really truly was kismet.
Let's see. Do you have any lyrics like this in your song? Reclaiming her lips, he crushed her to his chest. She felt an electric jolt as the hollows of her curvy body were pressed into his hard body. The embrace was at first surprisingly gentle, but it rapidly became punishing and passionate.
Good grief.
Punishing? I feel like it shouldn't be punishing.
Well,
I don't know. I don't want to tell. I'm not going to be your authority on feminism, but come on.
Punishing and passionate.
The two P's of love. Thank you, Myron, for sending us a copy of The Bader-Meinhof Affair.
Yeah, thank you.
We are getting great Bader-Meinhof stories, which will have been in last month's addenda by the time you hear this. What else did you...
The only last thing I would like to say, Ken, is that listeners who enjoy the program can support us at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Your generous contributions help keep the show on the air, and they warm the cockles of our hearts.
They do. And I believe listeners also have cockles warmed when they get an extra omnibus every month.
That's right.
By way of the addenda show.
An extra omnibus, and at different Patreon levels, there are different bits of fan service we provide, including a Zoom call with you if you support the show at one of our levels. There's a Zoom level.
There's an even higher super secret level where we will send you a romance novel we have written about the two of us.
With the passionate and also punishing embrace.
At the $1,000 level, we send you Slash Fiction.
Slash Fiction, which includes you. You are caught in the punishing embrace.
You're the third party. Welcome aboard. It's the Bader-Meinhof U affair, baby. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Now, we hope and pray that the catastrophe that blows the top off the St. Louis Arch may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence is passionate rather than punishing, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.